mi le aye o yo ladun yo tun jo ni oko le mi yo si se o mo pe o boya o mi ju wa ni le aye o yo ladun yo tun jo ni oko le mi yo si se o mo pe o boya o.
Fisayo Okari with your immigration news roundup from Documented. You're listening to a song, Irin Ajo, by Beautiful Nubia and the Roots Renaissance Band. The song, Irin Ajo, is in Yoruba, the only other language I speak. And it means, and it's about each person's journey on earth. Beautiful Nubia is saying, our journey on earth, though difficult and long, shall be filled with happiness, and in the end, everybody will get their due, either good or bad. You're listening to Documented Immigration News Roundup. In the news this week, who is Brianna Suggs? The home of Brianna Suggs, Mayor Adams' top campaign fundraiser and a former lobbyist for Chinatown Developers, was raided by the FBI as part of a corruption investigation. Read the full report on docu.nyc/Suggs. Again, it's docu.nyc/Suggs, S-U-G-G-S. In another news story undocumented, ICE deportation orders have reached a 25-year height as migrants miss notices amidst New York City government's shelter evictions. With each change of address, migrants say it becomes harder to track important hearing dates they must attend that are only sent through the mail. Read the report on docu.nyc/deportation orders. Again, it's docu.nyc/deportation orders, ORDERS. You're listening to Documented, and I am Fisayo Okari. Our lead story for today's episode is about understanding this new wave of African migration to the city. Joining us today is Diane Enobabo, a PhD student at CUNY's Earth and Environmental Sciences program. Diane's research interests are around Black geographies, Africana and African diaspora geopolitics, migration and mobility, with more than a decade's work of experience and advocacy in the field. Recently, she founded a rapid response call in New York called BAMSA, Black and Arab Migrant Solidarity Alliance, which has been on the front line of New York City's recent humanitarian migrant crisis. Thank you for joining me today, Diane, and for creating time to speak with me. So we first got to know each other in July.
Yes.
When a set of migrants, mostly North African and Arab men, were bused to a city temporary shelter respite site for 8 days and eventually weeks. They had no access to any functioning shower in their building. And along with a farm that was close by, opposite the shelter, you worked together to organize resources for them to take showers at a nearby public pool, which after the reporting and other interviews I did on this story, as well as an email correspondence with the mayor's press office, we realized that it was the city's plan for the men to temporarily make use of the showers at the public pools, but the men were not told and given directions on how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm highlighting this here to situate what happened in July as a subset of larger structural issues that you've encountered while working with the migrant men, which we're going to discuss today.
Yeah.
You co-founded Black and Arab Migrant Solidarity Alliance, which you've described as an autonomous collective of concerned citizens. Essentially, BAMSA began in response to the needs of roughly 500 asylum seekers who the city was sheltering in the unfinished commercial building on Stockton Street and Lewis Avenue in Brooklyn.
Yes, exactly.
So, Diane, can you speak to what you've learned and seen over the past few months of providing assistance to the newly arrived immigrants in New York?
Absolutely. Also, Fissa, I want to say thank you, because without your reporting, we wouldn't have been able to bring the type of political attention that we wanted to the situation initially. So as a rundown with what BAMSA was, yes, it's called the Black and Arab Migrant Solidarity Alliance. And I'm a co-founder with another person. This person's also a cultural worker as well. And we thought between both of our skill sets and our networks, we could bring attention to this crisis as we saw it. We didn't understand it was organized abandonment or neglect. We just thought it was a one-off moment of crisis and then close out our initiative. How I got there was that my friend, Marielle, who is a longtime organizer and volunteer at Bushwick City Farms, called and told me that what was going on in front of the farm was similar to the work I've done in Latin America. And I thought to myself, no way. I'm doing my PhD and I'm studying African Caribbean migrants that are traveling through Brazil to the US-Mexico border. And I've been doing this work for a decade, also organizing as well as a migrant rights advocate. And I thought to myself, that's impossible. But the day I got there, I saw literally what I've seen in Tapachula, Mexico and Sao Paulo, which is folks coming from the continent, particularly seeking asylum and trying to be newly integrated into these new communities on their way to the final destination that they desire. So we just hit the ground running, because as you said, when we got there, the biggest issue was accessing showers, toilets. The building wasn't finished. And many of the folks that were at Stockton were relying on the farm in Bushwick for all of their needs. We knew that this could potentially be a real struggle, because the farm was already supporting other underserved communities in that area, including NYSHA, other DHS spaces. So our biggest thing was that we didn't want there to be some sort of xenophobic activity happening, because no one was given an alert or was prepared for this amount of people to be at the respite center. Historically, Bushwick has been inclusive of different types of working people of color, but there still lacks a particularly continental or even Afro-Caribbean organization or nonprofit that's there. And we knew that that type of community work needed to happen so people wouldn't exhibit some sort of xenophobic behavior given scarcity. So when we got started, we were really focused on Eid. That was the weekend of Eid. And we wanted to make sure that the men were able to wash their feet and hands.
So what was happening inside the respite center that weekend?
What was happening inside the respite centers is that they were being bullied by the security for washing inside the sink because they hadn't had showers yet. They were doing it religiously. From there, we decided, okay, not only will we try to help with the coordination, because other mutual aid groups were helping with the showers, but we would try to get cultural and more so religious specific items to the farms. We decided to start our own collective as a rapid response call to bring together nonprofits and organizations, activists to come into Brooklyn, because we thought this was an oversight. And what we learned from the first rapid response call was that not only was this not necessarily an oversight, this was actually organized neglect being activated by the city.
You're currently listening to Documented Immigration News Roundup on WBAI, talking about understanding this new wave of African migration to the city. With us is Diane Enobabo, a PhD candidate at CUNY and the co-founder of BAMSA.
With the help of Melissa Johnson, who is an organizer with Black Alliance for Just Immigration, we had a call with the city. And then we learned that, oh, this is actually very much a structural racist issue happening on behalf of the city that is not isolated in Brooklyn, but is also something you can find in Queens, the Bronx, and Manhattan. And from there, we were also introduced to the work of Adama, who's at Africana in Harlem, So as things went on, we realized that, okay, the mutual aid is not enough. We're going to actually have to bring direct services to these folks to get them mobile in the city. So the next initiative that we took on was trying to get ID NYC. We thought, so simple, we'll just help with translation and interpretation, because many of the civil society organizations didn't have the capacity for Arabic and French and African indigenous languages. So we were certain that we just need to bring people with the help. And what we learned was there was much more complication than anticipated, primarily that the guys at Stockton and everyone at respite centers did not have residency. And it's worthwhile to backtrack and talk about the difference between a respite center and a DHS shelter. Long story short, the shelters, which are primarily family shelters, have different type of regulation than the respite centers, which are under the Office of Emergency Management. And thank you, Fisaya, for also doing that critical work and investigation for us to figure out the difference. That was pivotal. For that reason, there are different regulations and different standards between both places. One of the biggest things is that the men at respite centers do not have access to case management. They don't have residency. Because they didn't have residency, we couldn't actually help them apply for IDNYC, nor could we have their cases escalated. We escalated this issue with the help of Baji to the public advocate's office. We realized from there this was a bigger municipal issue. This was not a low-level thing. So as we were doing the mutual aid work, we were concisely creating political rhetoric for folks to understand the specific type of crisis that was happening, and for folks to also understand that this crisis is actually manufactured by neglect and oversight of city and other nonprofit organizations in the city, including NYIC. As earnest as some members are within these organizations, the structures themselves are severe places to witness cracks in the system. Me and the person I started this with always held that we would never turn into a nonprofit, because that was never the goal. The goal was to bring nonprofits to come, or culture workers, anyone to just come and then build something else. Initially, the end date was September 9th. We're finally ending this weekend, November 11th.
Why are you guys pivoting to political education and cultural advocacy?
We recognize that the capacity is very limited, and it wasn't our intention to continue on past those 2 months, because we want to also make the critique that if we've had to do this work for 2 months and now it's moving to 4 months and there still hasn't been enough attention placed on this issue and mutual aid is still fixing the problem, there is a structural issue. This was contentious and acknowledged neglect by the city. But it's not to say that the work will end. So from Bushwick City Farms, many of the folks that came through BAMSA will continue to work. We'll also continue to elevate the nonprofits that did support us with, whether if it's food for Muslims Giving Back or direct services, which we sent all of our folks out to Harlem to get help from Adama.
Let's pause for a moment. Adama Ba, I know who Adama Ba is. She's a key figure for African and Black migrants and other immigrants as well that have been arriving recently. And I would like us to put a quick spotlight on who she is.
Yeah, absolutely. So Adama Ba is the ED and founder of Africana, which is a nonprofit newly founded in Harlem, primarily organized to service new African migrants. And so not only has her place become a place to get direct services and tied into social services by the city, but it now is a cultural front to understanding this new wave of African migration into the city. She started off as an activist, and she still is. And she and Power Mahu are the greeters at Port Authority, which is where the buses come in from the U.S. South and the West that are filled with migrants to actually be processed at Roosevelt. So she's a part of this thing from point A to Z. Another thing, too, is that because her office is open to everyone, there's so many people that go through there.
Yes, I remember seeing in a brief Adama wrote via email, which I was privy to, given the reporting I've been doing and in conversations we've had while visiting Africana in Harlem, and even in discussions African services organizations had with city government officials just this week, that for the past couple months, Adama's office has been encountering 300 to 400 migrant men daily, many of them from African countries, including Senegal, Mauritania, Tunisia, Libya, Sudan, Eritrea, Burkina Faso, And you also said to me several times that the way African migrants and asylum seekers have been arriving in New York City has been starkly different from the way most migrants from other countries arrive. In fact, in this brief Adama wrote, actually, I will just read the email excerpts from the email right now for people to hear. This was a follow-up conversation to a conversation with city government officials that took place this Tuesday. So here it says 40% of Black migrants arrive in New York City by airplane, 10% by train, 49% by bus, and just 1% have arrived through Texas state government funded buses. And these are just numbers and data that you have been able to gather from over the past few months, not like an official census or anything.
There has yet to be an official record by the city.
So hundreds of them have been going to Adama to seek assistance for IDNYC card applications and ask questions about asylum applications, employment, and housing opportunities.
Yeah, primarily her office is used for IDNYC because she's the only organization right now offering residency for those that don't have it so they can receive their mail. Not only IDNYC, but Medicaid cards, they will hold it for newly arrived asylum seekers for no charge. And that's not common. There's no other organization actually that's doing that free of charge. And because she has such a great relationship with the city, she usually is on top of the news and the policy, which literally changes every day.
Recently, BAMSA won the AJ Musti grant.
Yes.
$5,000.
Yeah.
One part of the grant is being used for ESL classes. The rest of the grant is being used to work on data, capturing what is happening in African service organizations. How does incorrect or weak data on African communities create missed opportunities to secure resources and build long-lasting infrastructures to support service-based organizations and nonprofits providing assistance to immigrants in the city?
When I started, I was looking for any type of report, anything that spoke to why there were so many Mauritanians here. Nothing. I thought to myself, this is actually similar oversight that's happening in Mexico in terms of the diversity of people who are coming. And through my research, I've also discovered that when reporting does happen, especially in the United States, government officials are more likely than not to not count country of origin, but country that last visa has come from as residency or the last place to hold somebody's nationality. So why is that important? So for the past 10 to 15 years, we've had continental Africans take long distance migratory journeys through Latin America instead of the traditional routes of Europe and then into the United States or Canada. The reason why this type of migration has eased a mobility that isn't necessarily as common if you were to be invited via visa come straight to the United States is because the United States has different visa protocols and for those coming in from Latin America. And Latin America has started to shift its own visa requirements, especially requirements for residency. So you'll see African immigrants coming in on Brazilian papers, papers from Nicaragua, Mexico, because they were given residency there. And it made it easier for them to apply for residency in the United States. Every case is different, but that's a way of explaining this phenomenon of missing the numbers of African folks coming from the continent. And the oversight of not capturing the data, we really could not say who needed what type of resource. So, for example, we tried to design a political education ESL class to prepare these guys for any type of actually housing situation in English. And specifically, we were really worried about the October 20th date, which ended the 60-day, which was the start really of the end of 60-day stay in the New York respite and shelter system under the mayor. And we knew that this policy was not a recommendation of any organization. Faith-based, nonprofit, any civil society actor would tell you that's a bad idea. And so we were so worried because there wasn't a plan of what to do after. And we started the class and it was led by two professors, one at the New School and one at CUNY that had worked with migrant groups before and had done ESL before. And so this political education ESL was supposed to combine both the political education of understanding how to advocate for yourself in terms of housing in a city that is shifting its status of right to shelter, and how you do that in English. Because there are no numbers, you know, we started off with thinking we'll just need Arabic translation and French. We ended up needing a specific type of Arabic, Pular, versions of Pular. We needed versions of Wolof. And then toward the end, we realized, okay, we have a significant amount of students who are not able to read nor write. Where's the accounting for that? If we don't know these things, how can we be sure that people are getting the information that they need to be mobile and eventually leave New York City? As a researcher, I know that data is important. Now I'm seeing why data is important. So I'm putting attention on this before we miss a moment to really chronicle this, to prepare for the future, really, and fix some of the problems now.
You mentioned that migrants need to learn ESL for political education purposes and also for when they want to or need to leave New York City. Amidst this shelter evictions and shelter shuffle in New York, have there been migrants who have indicated to you guys that they want to leave New York City and why?
Not only have some asked us they want to leave, I have a good amount now that have left and are living successful lives. There are guys I talked to at the beginning in passing, you may want to try Texas. And some are like, New York is where it's at. Those same people are calling me from my hometown. One went to my hometown, which is a suburb outside of Dallas, and was like, you are right. It's great here. I'm already working. I just need to make sure my papers are regulated.
That's interesting because in the media and a lot of people's knowledge, the Texas government has been saying migrants should leave Texas. So it's interesting for you to say that, like, you grew up in Texas and in Texas, you lived within a community that was more welcoming of migrants compared to New York.
Mm-hmm. I think things are shifting. I think the government doesn't always represent the people. And the governor of Texas, he's not amicable to any type of immigrant, not even like historic, because Texas is on the border of Mexico. There's just a history of border shifting that happens there. We have a different even racialization logic that speaks to this border. So even our understanding of who is an immigrant is not a nation understanding. It's a very specific region, location-based understanding. He doesn't even want to acknowledge that. People are being sent from Texas, Arizona, all of these places to sanctuary cities as a political move. But that doesn't mean that because a city or state has that status, just like right to shelter, the people or the infrastructure is amicable to newly arrived immigrants. There are different things that have to be taken into account. And so in the case of Texas, as long as there's work and cheap housing, it's going to be amicable to newly arrived immigrants because that's what people need, cheap housing and work. And then, of course, having their documents regulated so they can be full participants in a system that's taking their taxes. We had some go to Maine to meet, like we had one in particular who met with the Congolese community in Maine, and he had a second cousin that was there. So he's working and he's fine now. We have a couple that went to Canada, and their situation will be very vastly different than the ones in the United States because Canada will regulate their papers sooner.
Sounds like the mayor's plan to get people to leave New York City might indeed work.
Yeah, but then New York will miss the incredible opportunity that other places are going to take. It's not by mistake that these economies outside of New York are doing better. It's because they've opened up in their own ways the way to absorb new people who can work. That's why the Mauritanian community is doing well in Ohio. It's these places where the housing is cheap, there's work in factories, and so people can start to save and build the foundation for the community. New York was historically like that. It was organized historically to be that. We're in a new phase of the city, and the exclusion is already happening for Native New Yorkers. Like, the mayor could care less if Native New Yorkers can live here. Mm-hmm. Topless of new immigrants, but that's a failure on the city. And that's sad because you have the opportunity to revitalize and be the strongest city in the world and you're missing it.
Thank you so much. Run out of time. I'm sure that we could go on and delve into other topics.
Thank you so much, Bethaya. And I want to thank you again for your reporting and coverage of all of this because you are the one that's really archiving what is happening to our community, the African migrant community. Not just for us in New York, but for all over the world. It's voices like yours that make sure we're marked in history because this is temporary. And we're going to look back and be like, wow, that was messed up.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I also have to say thank you to Documented and WBAI for even providing the platform for these stories to be told in the first place. You've been listening to Documented Immigration News Roundup.
I am Fisayo Okare. In other immigration news today, John Jay College has been asked by the federal government and New York State to use its North Hall space to serve as a processing center where asylum seekers can receive their work authorization papers and start their asylum claim process. From now through mid-November, migrants from many countries will meet on an appointment basis with representatives from the U.S. Customs and Immigration Service and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. They anticipate issuing 300 appointments per day, and the center will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday to Friday. I am Fisayo Okare. This is Documented Immigration News Roundup. For more immigration news, go to docu.nyc. Thank you for listening. Until next time, bye for now.
FM, WBAI, New York.
From the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Aaliyah Fisher. Today on Audiophiles, we hear from New Yorkers personally affected by the Israel-Palestine conflict.
I have a lot of family and friends that are there, that are really terrified, that are dead, that are injured, and this has to stop.
The Palestinian coverage is minimal, so we feel silenced.
We'll learn about efforts to limit how police and school safety officers use physical force on students in stressful situations.
There's nothing that anybody can tell me that would rationalize using restraints on a five-year-old.
Then we visit the South Bronx, where one local artist is bringing art accessibility to her community.
This is therapy for folks, and this is a therapeutic practice to come and express themselves freely in space with other community members.
And what these cute doggies had to say at the Bronx Halloween Dog Parade.
My parents put me in this mermaid costume, which I love.
All that and more here on Audiophiles. Protests for Palestinian liberation are ongoing since the October 7th attack by Hamas fighters that killed more than 1,400 Israelis and kidnapped more than 200 others. And the continuous Israeli bombing in Gaza and ground invasion has killed more than 8,300 Palestinians, with the death toll continuing to rise every day. Reports of anti-Semitic and Islamophobic hate crimes are up around the country and the world. 32 journalists have been killed in the conflict, including 28 Palestinian and 4 Israelis. Here in New York, public outcry continues daily. Reporter Alex Creel spoke to New Yorkers about how the conflict is affecting them and their loved ones and sent this report.
As a third-generation Jewish New Yorker who has spent time in Israel and Palestine doing human rights reporting, as soon as I heard about the Hamas attack over the weekend of October 7th, I nervously checked social media for what I knew would be massive retaliation against Palestinians and protests worldwide. Here in the city, one of the first rallies I covered was on East 47th Street with Mayor Eric Adams as the headlining speaker.
This is the place that our voices must raise and cascade throughout the entire country.
A heavy police presence was palpable. Like many other members of the press and public, I had to go through a metal detector and body search. Mayor Adams and Governor Hochul pledged ongoing financial support for Israel.
We will give generously. We must reach deep into our pockets because there are those who live far away. But we are united as one family because New York and Israel will always stand together.
Meanwhile, the city was full of people who have come out against the ongoing bomb in Gaza and apartheid in Israel. Protests in solidarity with Palestine are heavily policed, but without the stages, lights, or politicians, and they continue almost daily.
My parents are American citizens, and they are stuck by the borders. My dad is 78, and my mom is 70 years old, and we can't do nothing about it.
Over the following days, I attended rallies throughout the city, speaking to people from Palestine who were trying to get their families to safety and those whose families had already died. The ongoing protests call for stopping the bombing of civilians in Gaza. But a ceasefire is just the beginning of their demands. Many people passionately criticize the occupation of Palestine and the Israeli apartheid regime, but were afraid to speak on the record.
I've taken every single day to talk as much as I can on social media, and just every single day seeing the grueling images of the children dying, it has been one of the most heartbreaking things ever. And, you know, it's just It's very hard to deal with that and just see that every single day, all the children that are being murdered.
So this is what we have to tell Biden and the administration of the U.S. to help the Palestinians, because all the speech that I've heard, it made me feel as an American Muslim that I don't matter as a Muslim, as a woman.
The horrific violence and ongoing bombings of civilians in Palestine brought thousands of New Yorkers into the streets in protest. Two people who did not want to be recorded said that it feels similar to after the